myth-busting season. This is the post-family barbecue debrief that you've always wanted, where you either arm yourself with some serious comebacks or finally say what you wish you'd said. Let's get into it. I ain't afraid of a myth. Let's use some science, not an online article written by an idiot. I ain't afraid of no ghost. Come get me.
The big ADHD myth. Are there really more neurodivergent children now than there was 20 or 30 years ago? What are we really looking at? Is this a product of screens, social media, the way the society has changed? We are going to jump into that today with Sal and Kat. If you haven't listened to their last episode, please do that. It is into the show notes. But very quickly, Sal is a pediatric OT and Kat is a pediatric speechy. Sal and Kat both have got lived experience of being in the neurodivergent space with people that they know or in their family, and they've also worked inside the system and out and know what it's like to be a mum advocating hard for their children. So they've been on both sides of it, which is perfect for this podcast. The topic is the ADHD myth. There wasn't kids like this back in the day. I've never heard of a child needing Ritalin at 7 or 8. Do you think that's true? Are there more neurodivergent children now or are there less? Is it diagnosis? What is it that we're seeing?
I think that's a really good question and something that's really on topic because we get asked that all the time. And I absolutely, from everything that I've learned and I've read, can say that we haven't had an increase in people with ADHD, or anyone who is neurodivergent in any way. It's just that we have more tools to be able to diagnose. We're all a lot more educated in this space to be able to recognize and understand what's going on for ourselves. And also the systems have absolutely changed, meaning that our environments are much harder unless you fit in a specific box, right? Meaning that more people are trying to understand why they don't fit in that box and wanting some solutions to that.
Sally, I completely agree with you and I think it's such a myth that holds back so many people and minimises what we're seeing for ourselves and our kids. Kat, from the communication perspective, what do you think has changed in classroom that makes the differences more visible? Because if they were all there before, why are we noticing them so much more? What is it about the classroom do you think that's changed?
Yeah, so if we go back to what the classrooms look like 30 years ago, further back than that, it was a lot around learning facts, remembering facts. A lot of the tests, I think back to even sort of my social studies in primary school, you just learnt about the bush rangers and then you did a little talk about the bush rangers. Now we've got academic language that is embedded within learning right from prep. I mean, it's great that children are getting exposed to more complex and varied vocabulary. I think that's always a good thing. But when they're also having to integrate academic language, which is more complex while they're still learning basic literacy and numeracy skills, we can see that the children just cannot keep up with that. And like we hear that where there's a saying that if your child is falling behind, in air quotes, by grade 3, then it's going to be harder to catch up because that's when the language changes from learning to read to reading to learn. So by grade 3, which they're still very little, some may still be getting a grasp of some literacy in their spoken language abilities. They're then being asked to do their maths. They're asking to analyse text. They're being asked to describe and differentiate and predict. And some of these are high-level skills in the language around them. Is more complex, and there is published research and documentation, which if you want it, we can give you the links to that, to say that that has changed. And so has the push around standardised testing and curriculum. Like we know, bringing in the national curriculum, that means everybody has to be speaking the same language.
Completely agree, but what wondering, with those expectations and how they've increased, how does that then make us notice more neurodivergent children? Like, how does it translate?
It translates into how the children are being taught and they may be missing more nuances in terms of, they may not have that grounding in spoken language that's a really solid foundation, and then the jump, the expectations get harder. And so what we know is when the expectations exceed a child's abilities, that's when they fall off that cliff of competency. And so then that leads to you getting stress, you're falling behind, it's impacting social interactions. Yeah, because they're not competent.
Do you mean like a child going, I don't want to sit down and do the reading because it's too hard, I don't know what to do, or like what they are teaching or the expectations on them in that moment, they're like, I would rather do anything but this, and I know that if I do that, I'm going to get to go see the principal and that is going to be better. Like, how does it play out?
Yeah, that could be a scenario that we would see. The statistics around the AEDC data around developmental vulnerability, though, is actually telling us that there are more children that are struggling with their communication skills when they enter school. That is statistical data that we are finding. But I don't know whether that is anything.
So when you're talking, Kat, I'm just imagining that as soon as you've said kids are coming into prep and their communication is different or delayed, I would imagine old Uncle Ned at the family barbecue would be going, well, I told you it was the screens. It's the screens. There's nothing wrong with him. It's just the screens. Where do you think all that conversation comes in?
I think this will be an interesting one. I'm keen to hear what you think, Sal. I think that is a very simplistic and a very easy way to blame the screens. But I also think we need to look at the changes in our family dynamics. It was that whole pandemic that has affected our, like, economically, stress-wise. I mean, I think family units under more and more pressure just to get by. Add in the fact that we've got more recognised neurodivergence within families. And what happens with that is that children may not be being spoken to as much or have had as much opportunity to have playful back and forth interaction and conversations with their siblings, with their neighbours, with their parents, than they may have previously. Because we know that a child's vocabulary, the amount of words and the variety of words that they speak when they enter school, is a strong indicator of success. So it's multifaceted, but we also know, and I'll throw to Sal, because we know there is research around screens. That's something everyone will have their opinions and their thoughts around, but I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I think taking away a screen doesn't necessarily support a parent to be able to connect and communicate with their child without knowing how to do that.
Yeah, I'm collecting my thoughts because I agree with what you're saying. And Kat, before you were talking about the AEDC data telling us that more children are entering school developmentally vulnerable than ever before, which is what we are seeing in our classrooms. We're seeing this throughout our classrooms. And absolutely the big shift that happened in the pandemic has made a difference to the way in which our families work and live and communicate with one another. So yes, absolutely, like, there is a place that technology has influenced our worlds and how screens have actually impacted development, right? We are seeing this and there is research supporting this. And so then I guess the question is, when we're getting to school, when children are entering school, and from like a developmental perspective, when there isn't that readiness, and by readiness, what I mean is children, their bodies aren't used to participating in a group song with just a teacher giving an instruction, right? They're not getting the dopamine hit from that level of experience, right, anymore. Teachers are saying it over and over again. I feel like what I am giving is not enough. And because children are so used to, there was just recently a study done, which I can link that, but it was just talking about the progression of children's television, of what it even looks like when you watch a child's TV show now, how full on it is, right? And the dopamine hits you're getting and the stimulation you're getting from that experience, opposed to what you were getting when we were younger, and how much that impacts things. So we have children, right, who are entering school who absolutely have had a lot of access to screens. And that's, I'm not coming from a place of blame or shame or anything like that. We all lived through a pandemic. I know myself, Kat and I were working together at the time, and it was quite a very traumatic time in everybody's life. I had a six-month-old at the time working full-time, you know, often having to, you know, support him whilst trying to manage a job. And, you know, when we all thought we were going to die, like, screens became somewhat of our saviour there. But they have continued to be such a big part of all of our lives. And none of us, especially in this community, I think, have had enough time to actually come down from all of that, to come back down to a baseline without catastrophic sort of life events going on in our world, right? And we're all in this sort of overdrive, which affects our ability to engage and connect with our children. So that's not unique to parents. It's like our teachers as well. It's definitely something that's an interplay, and it does impact our children's development.
I agree totally with what you've said, and I know what you mean. It's not about the screens. The screens are like a byproduct of how society's changed. Like, that's realistic, because even with what we're seeing around child safety and risk and our knowledge and understanding of there are probably pedophiles living in our area, like, and the way that we understand grooming, we're more onto it, et cetera, right? So the chances are a lot less that if my child has a friend over, I'm going to send them down to the corner shop and let them buy lemonade. And that is a skill building thing that we used to do, that my mum used to do with myself and my best friend. She didn't call my best friend's mother to make sure it was okay. That was something that was done quite often. But yet when my kids have a play date, maybe they'll want to go on Minecraft and build a world together rather than going down to the shops, for example, right? And it's not about the screen, but it is about the screen. And I was wondering, for kids, for example, who might be a little bit delayed in gross motor skills, is not riding the bike, going down to the park, jumping on the slide with your friend, is that missing the opportunity to have those skills? Because for a child that's got gross motor skills that are delayed, maybe they have to practice that like a lot more than other children. I was wondering, do you think that's got part of it?
Absolutely. That's what I was trying to say before as well, about the impact of society and not being of the world, everything that's happening. It's all happening right in front of us on our phones, on the news. We've got all the problems of the world in our living room now, and they're happening all the time. We know more than ever before, like you were saying, about pedophiles, and even the idea that, yeah, they could be living in our area, or when our children are, like when I post a harmless photo online about my child, someone could be putting that on the dark web and turning it into something horrific. Like, we are now even more hyper vigilant than we ever have before. And that is absolutely impacting development. That's absolutely impacting children's sense of self and confidence in having risky play and being out in our communities, because we're terrified. I know, like, if my son, the other day we were riding like just on the coastal pathway, and he like didn't hear me say, "I'm stopping to talk to my friend." And he rode off. And next minute I was like, He's kidnapped. Something has happened to him. Where is he? Then my husband finds him. He's hysterically riding back with this man like chasing after him. And my initial thought was, like, he was trying to get away from this man who's going to do something to him. But then my husband, who doesn't necessarily have the same hypervigilant lens as I do, he's like, "Oh, he's such a nice bloke. This, he didn't have a top on or anything like that. He's running next to Henry on his bike. He was helping him find his mum." But the lens we take is not that.
So what I'm really wondering is, and I legitimately want to know, is do you think that when those children that have less opportunities to do those skills and practice them, and they go into prep, grade one, grade two, and those teachers are pretty adept at like finding and honing in on that child is really struggling with fine motor, for example. That child is still struggling to understand basic coordination and walking around a chair and not falling over, for example. And then maybe they have a conversation with the parent and the parent takes them for the assessment. Do you think that's a true delay, or do you think that is that child was already neurodivergent but they had less time and chances to do the skill, and that's contributing to more diagnosis? Like, which one is it? I actually don't know.
Yeah, so we know, like, developing any new skill, we need the opportunity to practice and to be able to refine that skill, and we need opportunities to do it in multiple different varied ways and, you know, to develop proficiency, to be able to, like, any skill. So a child who initially who has not had access to taking those risks, to developing those specific gross motor skills, absolutely wouldn't be able to develop them as proficiently as someone else. But there are underlying factors, right? So just because a child hasn't had lots of opportunity to explore in the local community and climb trees and do those sorts of things does not mean that they're not going to be able to climb or they're not going to be able to participate in the prep classroom or anything like that. But there are these underlying neurodevelopmental conditions that absolutely play into that. So that might be something like joint hypermobility when we're thinking about ASD diagnosis and the differences in our proprioceptive sense and where our body is in space and how we're able to execute and plan all of those movements. Those difficulties and those underlying, that's going to impact their motivation to actually want to engage in those sorts of risky play or gross motor activities, and therefore then and their ability to access those sorts of things safely. So I would think, though, for a prep classroom or a grade one classroom, being able to play in some basic play equipment and being able to navigate the room through sitting and all of that sort of stuff, children should be able to access those things if they've had some exposure to them. Yeah.
So I'll give you a communication example that I hope helps differentiate. So let's say we've got a little person who her home language, they speak Mandarin. And so they've been living within their community. And so there's mostly spoken Mandarin at home since birth. Parents speak some English, might be better written rather than spoken. And so what we're saying is that child doesn't have a language delay. They haven't learned English yet. So this is where, like, so it's the importance of going to a high-quality early learning centre comes into place, is because technically they're coming in because they haven't had the opportunity to learn English. They are technically not up to scratch to their peers when it comes to learning English. They don't have a communication delay. They need more opportunity to learn English because the rest of their schooling is going to be in English. But that doesn't mean that we might also have a child who home language is Mandarin. So that child with more exposure and the right input is going to be able to catch up with their peers and learn and speak in English and there won't be any issues. You might then have a child who has had that same home language upbringing, but mum and dad are saying actually they had trouble learning Mandarin as well. They don't just, when we're at home, they don't talk. They haven't spoken. It's been really hard to play with them. And so you're finding out that, okay, that's where you're seeing that difference between opportunity and exposure versus there's something underlying that's actually impacting their ability to develop communication.
And I'll add to that, because I think you've hit the nail on the head, and why both you and I, Kat, are so passionate about the early year space, about creating early childhood services that are inclusive and high quality, because we know our early childhood services are huge protective factors for children. And in a high quality, inclusive early learning service, children, regardless of what is happening in the home environment, our early learning services provide really rich opportunities for children to develop these skills.
Just coming back to the fact that it's like, how come we're seeing these differences or these delays once children hit school and it may not have been picked up in kindy? And I think it's worth thinking about that there's actually a real change in expectations on the children, but also the language that they're exposed to. So you think of kindies and home, it's often very, and this is what we teach as speech pathologists, that it's child-led, it's interest-based. And so that child is going to be set up for success, and they're having fun and they're playing and they're moving their bodies. And then we move into school and it becomes more adult directed, and we can't necessarily go with the flow. There's things that need to be done at different times, so following instructions. So I think you might also see some differences in a child's ability once they hit school. because that context completely changes.
And the ratio completely changes too. When we hit school, suddenly we have one teacher, whereas throughout in our early childhood services, we have the ratios change over time, starting at 1 to 4 when they're young, but we're moving to 1 to 11. And then there's quite a lot of support from an inclusion support perspective to support children then to access additional funding for the service and training for the service and all of those sorts of things.
Awesome. What a great conversation around that big myth, because both of you have raised things that I really didn't know the answer to. And I think when we're advocating for our kids, it's so important to have an understanding around some of those things, because otherwise when old Uncle Ned brings up, oh, well, you know, I didn't have anything wrong with me and I'm fine and all of those things, we can actually have an understanding of none of that is true. It's not a myth. This isn't social media or screens. It's society's changing. They were always there. We just noticed them differently as to before. So thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated it. And we are going to jump back in next week. Thank you so much.